Knocks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Justice Department weighs in on HB 2. It tells North Carolina the bill violates federal law and gives the state until Monday to promise not to implement it. Billions of dollars are at stake, but state leaders call the move a huge overreach. The city ponders a 1% tax hike to fund expenses next year. Meanwhile, some Charlotte leaders go west to study Denver's mass transit options. What did they learn? Though the governor continues to pass up opportunities to appear on this program, he chose the John Boy and Billy show to vent this week and makes news in the process. The Hornets' playoff hopes end in Miami, but they did better than any previous Charlotte team, and the PGA is back in town. Those and other stories on our weekly local news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here along with Sean Flynn. Welcome, Sean Flynn.
Thanks for having me.
From Time Warner Cable News, Eric Spanberg, senior writer, staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, is also with us, as is Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, from the beginning, there was the speculation about the intersection of HB 2, which mandates that individuals use restrooms and locker rooms that match the gender on their birth certificates, and Title IX, which bans discrimination in education. And this week, the U.S. Justice Department decided that HB 2 does, in fact, violate Title IX, and further, it violates Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Did anybody in Raleigh or here anticipate that part of the ruling?
Bob Hageman, the city attorney, had spoken about this several weeks ago when this whole issue of HB 2 started. He mentioned that precedent in the courts pointed in this direction, and it has played out exactly that way.
Yeah, and let's not forget there is still an outstanding federal lawsuit that was filed, you know, days after House Bill 2 was passed. In it, they directly state that, in their opinion, House Bill 2 violates not only Title IX and Title VII, but also the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Under the Law Clause. So, you know, what's interesting to me, and I had a fun – it was fun writing this line only because it's strange how House Bill 2, which is a very wide-ranging law, proponents of the bill have always said it's just about the bathrooms. And what was interesting about the Department of Justice letter is they say this is all about the bathroom. So it's all boiling down to that single issue, at least in terms of this iteration of a complaint from the U.S. Justice Department.
Title VII of the Civil Rights Act bans employment discrimination. In what way does Justice say that HB 2 discriminates against employees?
Well, it comes down to this whole issue of how you describe the word, you know, sex, how you describe that in terms of federal discrimination or anti-discrimination law. And what the plaintiffs are saying is that gender identity is covered under the law. Mm-hmm. What the opponents or what the proponents of HB 2 are saying is that that's not an accurate reading of the law.
And this is all stemming from 2014 when then Attorney General Eric Holder, I guess, instituted or made this push to include gender identity as part of a protected group within civil rights law.
But it wasn't just Eric Holder who did this. I mean, the U.S. Department of Education put out a notice.
Yeah.
Right. I believe it was in April of that year. It was either April or August, one of those A months, where they basically said, hey, look, we see gender expression and gender identity as a protected class under the definition of sex. And that's exactly where this falls down. I mean, it sounds funny to hear employment discrimination since, again, this complaint from the Department of Justice is all about bathrooms. But what it boils down to is it's specific to state employees because that's really where this – part of the bathroom ordinance focuses, but it says it's a form of discrimination because it treats those employees differently than non-transgender employees. So therefore, it falls under a form of discrimination.
Because they can't use the restroom based on their gender identity.
Correct.
Because they would have to use it
based
on biological sex. And so that's the whole fight.
Yeah.
Or
that's the whole
fight in terms of the bathrooms.
And it is an interesting point because this is a point that the Supreme Court I don't believe has actually addressed yet. And it looks like from, you know, based on what's happening here in North Carolina, that this probably is going to wind up at the Supreme Court.
And in fact, there's already been an appeal there because a lot of this is predicated on a recent decision by the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which ruled that a transgender high school student in rural Virginia, on the coast of Virginia, had the right to use the locker room or restroom of their choice in that high school. And that decision is also cited by the U.S. Department of Justice note.
It'll be interesting to see which happens first, whether this gets to the Supreme Court or they'll have that ninth Supreme Court justice.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Very good point.
And you know what's interesting? You now hear people on the right saying, now that you have Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee, you now hear people on the right saying, maybe we ought to go ahead and put that Merrick Garland guy in. You know, you're starting to hear that.
That's interesting. Yeah. Justice has given Governor McCrory and the legislature until Monday to respond by confirming, this is a quote, confirming that the state will not comply with our implement HB2. How unusual is the imposition of a deadline like that, and what is the usual response if and when they have done this before with these deadlines?
Well, I think where we should start with this is the response that we've gotten from House Speaker Tim Moore, which is
not only no, but
yeah, exactly. bathroom language, you might call it.
Yeah.
So it's already clear that the state is not going to answer by the end of Monday, or it looks clear that the state is
not
going to answer.
But the governor, according
Monday.
To the paper this morning, has prepared a response.
He is preparing a response.
It looks like they have decided, they being the Republicans in Raleigh, have decided that McCrory will respond by the deadline, but probably the legislature won't.
Well, that's what's interesting to me, too, is because you've got basically the three most powerful Republicans in Raleigh. You have Governor Pat McCrory saying, we will respond. He doesn't say what it will be, but we will respond by the deadline of close of business Monday. You have, as Eric said, you have House Speaker Tim Moore saying, no, we're not going to do anything. That deadline is far too fast. We can't possibly do it. That's not how this works. And then you have Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger coming out and saying, well, we do have to file some kind of response. We can't just not respond. And what was also interesting to me is opponents of House Bill 2 brought up what I think is a fair point, which is, you know, the legislature is saying there's no way, or legislative leaders, I should say, are saying there's no way we could possibly agree to not enforce this law in 3 business days. But they passed the bill in 12 hours. And let's not forget that they also gave members of the public less than 20 minutes to read the bill before they opened public comment.
Well, maybe they haven't read it yet. See?
So let's talk about what's at stake here, because if they respond in the negative, and they obviously probably will respond by saying we're not going to repeal this, what's at stake? It's a lot of money.
Yeah, at least $800 million, I think, in
public education,
K-12 money,
right?
And more than $1 billion in university money.
So the total figure is around $2 billion.
Well, one of the things that was not in the Department of Justice letter is what happens if they don't respond, or they respond not the way the DOJ wants them to. They don't specifically lay out, if you don't respond or we don't like your response, you're going to lose this money the day after, or we're going to take you to court. So there's a lot of ambiguity on what is going to happen. I know when we were talking about Governor McCrory, he was speaking to the North Carolina Chamber of Government Affairs Conference 2 hours after he received this letter, and he's like, hey, folks, I haven't had a chance to even figure out what's going on here. The thing that I find fascinating about this is, if you think back 3 months ago, supporters of Jennifer Roberts and who pushed this LGBT rights really were focused on Charlotte. Okay. A couple months later, all of a sudden, this is a North Carolina issue. Now that you have the DOJ involved, all of a sudden, it's become a federal issue that all states may have to participate.
Well, I thought it was kind of funny because I was at the event where McCrory was speaking and Tim Boyum was interviewing him. There were a couple things going on there that were funny. The first, of course, is that the protesters outside could be heard inside the auditorium, and so they had to close the doors. And the governor made a comment about how, you know, blaring horns and cursing and swearing is no way to engage in dialogue, as our political leaders always like to say. But the second one is that he kept saying this is no longer just a North Carolina issue, as if that was a surprise. I mean, this basically from the moment HB2 was passed, turned into a national controversy.
Well, and you think about it, it was actually kind of under the radar national before that, because
right.
the reason why our the GOP in Raleigh even got involved with was because they were looking at the controversy around the Virginia case. And they were looking at it and seeing, boy, this is fertile ground. And you had groups. I can't remember the name of the group, but the Christian far right litigation group that was already sort of mobilizing around this issue of transgender and bathroom rights in that Virginia case. And our Republican leaders kind of saw an opening and wanted. McCrory was sending out press releases about that case, before Charlotte even passed its ordinance.
Is it at all likely for the federal government to pull Title IX funding while a court case may be pending, or would they have to wait?
They're not linked. Those two things are not linked. The Department of Justice is working on its track. That is an executive branch office.
So they could pull the funding.
Yeah, and here's the tricky thing about this funding. The numbers, that Sean laid out are accurate, but it's tricky to figure out exactly how much may be at stake here.
Right. What's the proportion?
Yeah, and it's not just a proportion, too, because it matters on how you count Title IX money and potentially other forms of federal funding that could be tied to this. I mean, the number that has been mentioned in the federal lawsuit and that has been floated around generally could be as high as $4.5 billion. Now, K-12 is getting, just less than $900 million. The university system itself is getting more than $1.2 billion. But then you also have to count, weigh things like the community college system.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of other aspects of this. And then there's federal grants for K-12. They're even in a different bucket. So we really don't know. And Sean was right to bring it up, because we asked the Justice Department, so what's at stake here? And all they would write back – and it was really interesting, because they would only write back a statement that they insisted we attributed to a general – just an official at the U.S. Department of Justice. So Mr. Official or Mrs. Official said that basically we hope that North Carolina does this voluntarily so they can continue to receive federal funds, or else we can take them to court.
Jennifer Roberts, the mayor of Charlotte, members of the Charlotte Chamber, went to Raleigh the other day to have a sit down with the legislature about this issue, and everybody is being quiet about what was discussed. Why?
Because I suspect there's a lot going on behind closed doors, and they're trying to hammer out a resolution. And I always find these things fascinating, because I always wonder, what are they saying? Because that's the stuff we all want to know.
Right.
But, we never get to see the sausage being made. And
that's not true. It's just
watching it right now.
We don't get to see the best parts of it.
Well, yeah, right?
I don't know whether to take some sense. Dare we have a sense of optimism about the fact that they are keeping quiet, and that means that there might actually be some traction. Productive.
That's the way I take it.
Track going on here. Yeah.
So Governor McCrory, in speaking to business leaders on Wednesday night, called the Justice Department letter something we've never seen regarding Washington overreach in my lifetime. Is that true? I remember George Wallace standing in the—
I was going to say, how old is he?
Yeah.
Right. School door with federal troops on the doorstep.
And to have just had, everybody in Charlotte saying the exact same thing about him in Raleigh is just— has he no sense of irony, or does he not care? I don't know.
The whole thing is overreach, because where does this start? The state said the city overreached by doing this, and then the city said the state overreached in its response, and the state says the federal government has overreached.
Meanwhile, Chip in Mooresville writes, Justice Department overreach? You mean like airport, toll lanes, Greensboro Council, Tom Ross firing, etc.?
Asheville Water.
Well, and that's the thing. Everybody loves to say overreach because it's a political buzzword. It is basically a way to tell your supporters the other guy isn't playing by the rules. And the funny thing is everybody seems to be reaching deeper and farther than they have in the past.
That's Tom Bullock from WFAE News. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with more of our weekly news roundup in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, providing new technologies designed to protect natural resources and meet the Carolinas' changing energy needs. More at duke-energy.com/power. power. Same-sex marriage is legal in all 50 states, but the attitude of many churches varies widely. Some denominations stand pat in their opposition, while others have made allowances to throw open the doors to same-sex couples. But even some of those churches, in those churches, controversy remains. A major Christian denomination is about to take up the topic at their general conference, so we take a look at religion and same-sex marriage on this program Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The GOP considers its future as Donald Trump becomes the apparent presidential nominee. Bernie Sanders wins Indiana and vows to continue his campaign. And the Justice Department says North Carolina's transgender bathroom law violates federal civil rights laws.
The News Roundup continues on the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. A program note before we continue. Back in January, we had our first voters roundtable on this program with voters from different perspectives on the program to talk about what's important to them this election season. And we're going to have another roundtable, and we want you to be involved. So get in touch with our producers and tell them a little bit about yourself, how you plan to vote, and the issues you're most interested in, and you may be on the next panel. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or go to wfae.org for more information. You can also email us, Twitter us, Facebook us right now with your take on the news that we're talking about. And we'll be talking about Charlotte leaders going west to study Denver's transportation plan, the city potential tax hike, news about debt and forgiveness for those of you who have mortgages that might be underwater, and more this hour. But we are, as we traditionally are, yes, stuck on HB2 because it has its tentacles in everything. 2 days prior to the Justice Department sending their letter to North Carolina saying you have to give us a response by Monday of next week about not implementing this, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission reiterated its stand that it is a civil rights violation to deny transgender employees access to a bathroom based on gender identity. Did state lawmakers take that into consideration when they wrote and passed HB2? I mean, we've known about equal employment opportunity rules forever.
No. I mean, the answer, honestly, is no. And part of it is because, in fairness, the rules are changing. The definitions are changing. I mean, if you think about where this country stood on the idea of what a traditional marriage was or what just the term marriage meant, as little as 2 years ago, it was still up for debate. Now it's, you know, a marriage can be between a man and a woman, or a man and a man, or a woman and a woman. The social norms are changing. This seems to be the latest front in the culture war. Mm. And I think that the Republican-led legislature just, you know, part of them truly believe this was a bathroom safety bill, as they love to say. They've never answered, however, why it is that if you want to continue to say this is just about the bathrooms, why were the other sections of this law, the minimum wage, the establishing of certain buckets for protected classes, the deliberate excluding of other buckets of protected classes, have never said why the rest of that stuff was necessary.
Meanwhile, Governor McCrory has been assiduously avoiding an appearance on this program. I'm not sure why, but he did appear this week on The Big Show with John Boy and Billy prior to receiving the Justice Department letter criticizing Bruce Springsteen, PayPal, and the Thought Police, and the Charlotte Observer, specifically an editorial recommending a boycott. So defend yourself.
Look what you've done.
Well, he got a lot of things wrong, one of which he said that was an editorial. It was actually an opinion column by my colleague, Peter St. Ange. And I think the governor was saying that we were encouraging boycotts of the state. Mm-hmm. That's not what Peter was doing there. He was saying that it would be a bad thing and it would be hurtful for Charlotte if the NBA, I think he was talking about the NBA, the All-Star game, if that pulled out, but it would be morally the right thing to happen. Mm. That's not exactly saying, you guys, come over here, boycott this state, get out, don't do it. That's two different
you
things.
You know, next thing you know, the governor will be making gross exaggerations about how many concert tickets Bruce Springsteen
sells.
Well,
I'm glad you brought that up, because on the John Billy show, John Boy and Billy show, he made much of the fact that only 8,000 Springsteen tickets had been sold, and that maybe that played a role in the cancellation.
You know, Bruce Springsteen, who I love, Bruce Springsteen. I love his music. Yeah. But he canceled a concert in Greensboro. By the way, they only had 8,000 tickets sold, with all respect. But Bruce doesn't mention that. They didn't quite get the ticket sales they wanted, but might have had something to do with it. But I love Bruce Springsteen. But for him to cancel a concert 2 days before the concert, where people traveled down there, all 8,000, over a bathroom policy, and I doubt he read it or understands it. Mm. And then a couple of other groups, the Jonas Brothers, and I don't know. Well, but besides that, everything's going pretty good. By the way, North Carolina, as of yesterday, was the fastest growing economy in the United States of America. Good.
Darn, we missed Bob Rayford. He wasn't in that cut.
Well, it's obvious why he chose to go on that show. They're disagreeing with him left and right.
Well, it's a national show.
Right.
It's on everywhere.
Well, which can I just point out the fun irony here? When he's talking about boycotting locally, Pat McCrory has been on Fox and Friends, the John Boy and Billy show, Meet the Press. He seems to love doing national media, which he accuses of conspiring against the state and besmirching the good name of North Carolina, and yet does not do shows locally to talk about this issue.
Let us address the allegation that he made that only 8,000 tickets were sold. WFAE's Sarah D'Elia did a little digging, Tom.
Yes, and it wasn't hard, and it was very easy to do. This is this is the basics of journalism. So she heard that and she goes, "Huh." calls the Coliseum in Greensboro and says, "So, how many tickets did you all sell for Bruce Springsteen? Is the governor right?" And they quickly replied, no, there were 15,000 tickets available. By the time the show was canceled, there were probably around 100 tickets left, and those more than likely would have been sold out before the show hit. So not only was where he got this 8,000 number from, nobody seems to know. And in the first move that I've seen of him apologizing for anything that has to do with HB2, he did tell the News and Observer's NC PolitiFact that he was wrong on the 8,000 number. Huh. He acknowledges the fact that more than, that the show likely would have been sold out, and that he swears he still loves Bruce Springsteen and, in fact, has Bruce Springsteen albums. Now, we also have not been able to verify any vinyls at the governor's mansion, but one has to ask, why is it that you want to go out there and just throw around this number? Not just in that clip you played, Mike, not once but twice.
Truthiness.
Yeah, it's just strange to me. Yeah.
Well, and I think that if you look at the track record, particularly since he's been governor and he's come under much more intense scrutiny and criticism, that John Boy and Billy's kind of like Linus in the blanket. He tends to go over there and sort of have the friendly audience. And politicians on both sides do this. This just happens to be his venue that he chooses.
He actually did appear on our Capitol tonight with Time Warner Cable News.
That's right, he did.
Yes, I've noticed that, too.
Shameless plug. I apologize. Yeah,
that's all right.
One of the reasons why he says that he does that is because we give him the time, and it's not necessarily just in broken sound bites. So that is one of the reasons why he says he comes on and talks on our
full
station.
A full hour is not enough time?
Another shameless plug. Moving on.
I think he just doesn't like you, Mike.
That could be, and there's some justification for that.
He does like Springsteen, but not Mike Collins.
The governor also called the Human Rights Campaign, which is the LGBT national organization, more powerful than the NRA, and called them Machiavellian. Hyperbole, or are they more powerful than the
extreme?
Yeah, I think that's a little hyperbolic. Yes.
That's even stretching hyperbole to another level.
Okay. Rabo Research, if that's how you say it, Red America, Blue America, that's the full name of it, conducted a poll which found that roughly half of North Carolinians supported and half disapproved of HB2. That same poll showed that 49% of North Carolinians disapproved of the way Governor McCrory handled HB2, and 36% approved. 48% support repeal, 34% are against the idea. And the poll had Attorney General Roy Cooper leading Pat McCrory 41-36%. Now, a previous Elon poll, which we talked about a few weeks ago, had Cooper ahead 48-42. So what, if anything, is pretty close, 6 points, 5 points. What, if anything, are we to take take from this? Are we to believe these polls with regard to who's ahead in the race?
I do think – I mean, it's so hard to tell. I do think that McCrory has probably lost a couple of points on this issue while it has been swirling around sort of with this intensity. The question is, you know, 3, 4, 5 months from now, do people still feel as strongly about it? Does it maintain its media momentum, for one thing? And then, of course, we are 31 minutes in, and we have not mentioned the presumptive Republican nominee, I don't think. So there is the whole issue of how do Donald Trump and Pat McCrory help or hurt one another on the ballot
We'll talk about that.
Well, one thing about this poll is, if I'm not mistaken, this poll also showed a very interesting contradiction in North Carolinians' minds, which is if you just focus on the bathroom section of House Bill 2, that there still is a majority of North Carolinians
that approve of it.
But when you say the words House Bill 2 writ large, their opinions quickly change. And I think that just shows – you know, it shows that there are a lot of people with differing views. Yeah. And, everybody's entitled to their view. The trick is how do you balance that as a politician? The last thing I'll say on that is this. House Bill 2 is obviously completely in flux. It's completely moving. And frankly, it may be beneficial to Pat McCrory if, in fact, as the person who the General Assembly is basically left trying to figure out what to do with this Department of Justice letter and the response – depending on his response and if, in fact, House Bill 2 is rendered moot in some form, this early in the election, it's not like his base is going to suddenly jump ship and vote for Roy Cooper.
Right.
Yeah. Right, especially if he's being forced to do this. Now, even if you look at the conference he was at with the chamber the other day, of his half hour, he spent upwards of 17, 18 minutes talking about the bathroom bill, and he got only about 8 to 9 minutes talking about his Carolina comeback and how North Carolina's had the best economic recovery the past 3 years, which is going to be his message moving forward, and he's going to try and stop talking about bathrooms and start talking about jobs.
Well, we ask listeners to chime in on all these things as we talk about them through Twitter and Facebook and email. And Bob emails, I predict the North Carolina GOP will reverse the bathroom portion of HB 2, while the portion that does not allow local governments to increase the minimum wage will remain. Julie on Facebook, so when the city gets overruled by the state, that's okay. But when the state gets overruled by the federal government, that's overreach. Do they not see the irony in this? And finally, on HB 2, Eric Frazier, you say that you would be shocked not to see an HB 2 referendum on the November ballot. In light of the Justice Department letter, are you taking that back?
That was before the Justice Department letter. I think the Justice Department letter sort of – that's the 800-pound gorilla that just kind of stormed into the room, knocking over all the furniture. And who knows where things are going to wind up with that.
So that's Eric with a C. Eric with a K. Eric Spanberg. You wrote an article about something that's been on a lot of people's minds, especially people in this area. Has Pat McCrory changed since becoming governor, or has the state in some way changed? He was a moderate, even a progressive mayor. That's how people thought of him here. But you say, and recent events provide evidence for this, that he's turned to the right. So which version of Pat McCrory is the real Pat McCrory? Would the real Pat McCrory please stand up?
The approach I was taking was trying to talk to people who had worked with him a lot as mayor and who are observing him as governor. And it was a mixed bag. But I think if any general consensus emerged, it was that he is surrounded by a much larger and much different group of people in terms of, you know, the state legislature, and also that viewing the political world through the prism of Charlotte versus a state of 10 million people and still a a majority who are in rural areas is very different. They're just very different things. And so it should not be surprising in the view of the people I was speaking to that he is having to do different things and moving to the right in a state where a more conservative version of Republicans is dominant in the General Assembly.
I covered Patrick McCrory when he was a mayor for several years, and he definitely seemed like he excelled when the governing body was Democrats. So he crossed over, he worked with Democrats. Here it's Republicans, and he doesn't want to show the fighting with the Republicans. Also, if you think about it, the city of Charlotte deals with specific issues, roads, police, public safety, things like that. That's where he can come across as strong. When you start getting into a lot of these social issues, which he's dealing with as governor, I think, I don't know if it's we just didn't see it when he was in Charlotte, or if it's the members in the state legislature are dominating the
conversation. Well, and think about when he was mayor, and Mike, you were here, you remember this. In fact, almost everyone in the room was probably here during the 2001 referendum, and there was the issue of the living wage, and that one kind of crossed into over into more of an issue like what we're seeing in the legislature in terms of controversy. And that probably killed the referendum single-handedly, although all those projects ended up being built later on.
Well, speaking of money, and you just mentioned the living wage, it's budget time at the city of Charlotte, and outgoing city manager Ron Carley has recommended a property tax hike, perhaps as small as 1%, to cover proposed expenses in next year's budget. This would be the third tax hike in 4 years. How likely are we to see a yes vote on city council for that?
I think you already see city council members sort of speaking out and saying they don't, that's not the road they want to go down. It looks like what you may very well see instead is them making up that money that they need by cutting garbage pickup to apartment complexes. I was speaking with some apartment complex developers and owners earlier this week, and that's what they kind of see coming.
Why
down
would
the
you
pike,
want to do
are,
that? Why would you want to? Why would you want? No, let me, why would you want to cut garbage collection to apartment complexes? It would seem to me to be economically much cheaper to pick up garbage at an apartment than at single family.
It actually is, and these developers,
most other cities don't, right?
Yeah, it is more. It is cheaper. It's more efficient, but it's not what most cities do, and that's Rowan Carley's argument. These developers were making actually a pretty good counter argument, and they were saying that, and take it for what it's worth, these are, you know, guys with a vested interest, but they were saying that you're in a growing city with lots of people moving here every day, and you're having a squeeze on affordable housing, and we've all seen this playing out over the years, and where what is the most affordable housing? It's apartments.
Sure.
And you're seeing that squeeze, you know, if you already have a market that's squeezed with a lot of demand. They say that they can barely meet the demands because there's so much of it. And you're not seeing rents come down, even though they're building all these apartments, because there's so much demand. And they say that when you add this, you know, this extra expense, they're just going to pass it on through to the, you know.
And the other option they're talking about is raising fees for garbage collection on everybody. And isn't a fee a tax by another name?
Oh, well, of course, yes. I mean, all governments play this game over and over again. The argument that city manager Ron Carley is making is that if you just raise the property tax, you're essentially making everyone invest in the police officers and firefighters that this money would
not
be
just residential
used,
but commercial,
right,
as
exactly
well.
You would have businesses as well as homeowners, and so that was the theory. But you know, as Eric is saying, there is this uneasiness of just that phrase that rolls off the tongue. Wait, three property tax hikes in 4 years? And remember, again, if you go back in Charlotte history, for many, many years, city managers love to tout the fact that we haven't raised taxes in X number of years, and all of a sudden, they can't say that anymore.
Why do we need to raise?
It wasn't just city managers. It was also the politicians.
Oh, well, absolutely. But I'm saying, you know, that was a hallmark.
I vividly remember 14 straight years, right, we haven't raised property taxes. Well, the water rate went up dramatically, and the sewer rate went up dramatically, and so the fee structures went up, but they're not property taxes.
Right. I'm not sure we have enough money to talk on, time to talk about this before we have to go to the break, but why do we need this extra money? Why are we short on cash?
Well, the argument is that they want to hire 75 employees with the police, 50 of whom would be sworn officers, and 18 firefighters to man a station up at North Lake Mall. And so,
plus a 3% raise for city employees.
Right, there are raises. But what they are saying, of course, is that this money is dedicated just to the additional hires. It would pay 61%, I believe, of those additional hires.
There's also talk of water and sewer bills being increased.
Yes.
We'll talk about that and more when we come back from the break. It's our weekly news roundup on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. So Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nantahala Outdoor Center, offering mountaintop zip line tours with panoramic views of the Smokies. More at NOC.com. Republicans consider their future as Donald Trump becomes the GOP's apparent presidential nominee. Bernie Sanders wins Indiana and vows to continue his campaign. And the Justice Department says North Carolina's transgender bathroom law violates federal civil rights law. But if you've been listening, you know that. A panel of journalists joins the guest host Derek McGinty for an analysis of this week's top national news on the National News Roundup, which follows this hour in 20 minutes. If you'd like to comment on what we're talking about, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or reach us through Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
This is the sound of protesters out on the streets of Egypt.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Duke says it hopes to produce or buy 8,000 megawatts of electricity by 2020 from wind, solar, or biomass.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's the Weekly News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer, Sean Flynn from Time Warner Cable News, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. You said something in the break, Sean, about when the city needs more money, or any municipality seems to need more money, it's always for
police officers and firefighters.
Because
you cannot say we don't need more police officers and firefighters. And I get that argument, and I understand that. The other thing I would say is that every time we have these manager proposals, the city council or county commission, they never come back with that full whatever percent tax. Okay, we will want a 10% property tax increase. No, we were able to lower to 8%.
Yeah.
We were able to lower it to 7%.
To quote Bull Durham, it's a miracle.
Yeah. Well, how much would 1%, a tax hike of 1%, add to city property owners' bills?
What was it a year?
I'm
trying to remember. Was it $36?
Yeah, I mean,
dollars. It was very minimal. 80% homeowners would pay less than a dollar a month.
I can tell you this, but only when – I mean, the numbers that we were in only were taking into consideration two things, that 1% tax increase, but also what is another tax increase, which is the water and sewer fees are going up. And that is not – voluntary.
And that's regressive.
And it, well, you can argue all property. Well, I guess actually sewer, you're right. It's more regressive. Yes. You're absolutely right. But the overall, the median income for a house in Charlotte, or the median cost rather for a house in Charlotte is about $141,000. They would pay $36.55 more per year with those two new taxes. So really.
But I do want to mention, you know, talking about policemen and firefighters. Now, remember, I think it was in about 7 or 8 years ago, then Police Chief Rodney Monroe, he asked for 250 more officers. He got 125. And now this time, I think Kerr Putney asked for what?
125. Right.
And he's ending up with 50/75, depending on.
But more people are moving here every day. So why aren't the tax revenues coming in from these additional residents?
They are. They absolutely are. But you have to think about a city as almost a living organism, because that money also now has to go with more residents come more students. So that's more schools. With more roads, you have more residents, you need more roads. You need, you know, to – there's a lot of infrastructure that you have to take care
of. And I believe even as little as a decade ago, the overall city budget was around $2 billion. Now we're talking $2.4
billion. So
there's a lot more money in the pot.
When do we expect a decision on what they're going to do?
Oh, they will vote on the final budget on June 13th. I mean, that will happen.
A group of Charlotte leaders went west to Denver, Colorado recently to check out their transportation system and to get ideas for Charlotte. Why did they choose Denver?
They chose Denver because Denver's been one of the most aggressive cities in terms of transit. They have spent $5.5 billion since 2004 on light rail and commuter rail. And this is the funny part if you're living in Charlotte, North Carolina. They went and got a tax passed not just in their city but in 8 counties. Imagine that.
Wow.
8 counties. Can you imagine if we went to 8 counties surrounding Charlotte and said,
well,
hop on board.
Which originally was in the plan for our light rail system.
Do the 8 counties that surround Denver touch Denver?
Yes.
And I know that Denver is notorious for having terrible traffic jams. Will this light rail system allow residents from these eight outlying counties?
Everyone benefits, and that was kind of the pitch. They had not passed a transit tax since 1973. They had one in 97 that failed by about 14 points, and then they came back in 04 with the plan that was approved, and it was 120 miles of rail.
So 40 Denver area mayors supported a voter-approved one-cent sales tax to underwrite expansion, a regional approach. Can that happen here, really?
Well, $1 billion, however many billion-dollar question, because I think back in 1994, back when they were first rolling out here in Charlotte, the idea for the half-cent sales tax that, you know, underwrote the Blue Line and all the other transit improvements that have been going on here, they originally wanted to do that with surrounding counties. And that was how it was originally rolled out. But the surrounding counties all said, tax increases. Yeah. We're not interested. And Mecklenburg went alone.
Well, even if you look at this Blue Line extension, it was supposed to go over 45, basically touching Cabarrus County. And
right.
They just ran out of cash, so it stops at UNC Charlotte.
Yeah. Yeah, and it may sound strange to people to hear that you have eight counties and 40 mayors supporting a transit system that's based in a city they are not necessarily part of. But if you stop and think about it, they really are. My sister lives in Denver. I go out there all the time. And really what this is if Denver is the core and this transit system are the spikes or the spokes, rather, that go out, you start turning these other like Golden and Aurora and all these other areas into the bedroom communities, which then – you know, begat restaurants and shopping centers and other things. And it really is an economic engine for Denver that allows those other cities and those other counties to prosper more than without.
So Brandon on Twitter writes, any chance of a tax increase to fund light rail or bus rapid transit?
Oh, well,
that road a number of times.
There's no doubt that a tax increase will have to be part of this if they are successful. A couple of big things. The first is the countywide cooperation you're talking about. But then secondly, remember, let's assume that a group of counties adjacent to Charlotte and Mecklenburg would agree. Guess who has to approve that taxing authority?
Right. And can I throw one other twist here? Let's not forget the transit situation, I shall call it, that's always harrowing even when it's not covered with 50,000 pounds of potatoes, and that's I-77, right?
Yeah.
Let's not forget that you had quite a few regional players ask Charlotte to vote down the continued support for I-77 tolls. I think one thing that we also have to it's easy to blame Raleigh in a situation like this, but I'm not sure the city of Charlotte has enough goodwill.
Yeah,
you also have to remember that the city of Charlotte went around the regional transportation group and went ahead with the streetcar when that wasn't the original
plan. Not using transit tax money, which is a
for
key
those
point.
People who may not be aware, 50,000 pounds of potatoes were dropped overnight on I-77 at Moorhead Street, which shut down the interstate. Would you like hash browns with your morning commute?
Bacon and butter.
Mecklenburg County Commission Chairman Trevor Fuller admitted to communicate to someone in Lincolnton why they should care about a regional mass transit vision is challenging. Is that even on their radar in Lincoln County?
Not at the moment. And some of the things that were just mentioned, those are good points. The well water is a little fouled up right now.
Well, and I think one thing that came out of this, listening to the Charlotte leaders talk about it in Colorado, is that they have to go out and, as they always say, educate, promote, however you want to describe it. People don't know what the transit plan is. They think it's the light rail and that's it. They have no idea that it has spokes and that there is a vision of a transit hub at Gateway Station and so on.
And one of those spokes would have been commuter rail from Charlotte to Huntersville or Huntersville to Charlotte, but
depending on what they still want to do. Right.
And one of the obstacles to that has been cooperation from Norfolk Southern. We ran into that with the Lynx Blue Line. And one of the things that they learned in the trip to Denver, that Denver said that working with the railroads to consolidate tracks and relocate operations was worse than working with the federal government.
That was my favorite quote of the whole story.
And yet, they succeeded. So did we learn anything from Denver that could be applied to Norfolk Southern here?
You know what I think they learned, really, and what we're talking about is it's going to be a tremendously difficult slog, and you have to find a group of really determined people that are willing to put their necks on the line. That's what they're going to have to do.
Meanwhile, Trevor Fuller, the chairman of the county commission, said something that kind of puzzled and troubled me. He said they weren't ready to go to the public to propose any ideas like this because we don't know, and I quote here, we don't know what we want to do. How can you communicate a vision when you don't really know what you want to accomplish? On this program, more than 1,000 times, that's hyperbole, by the way, we have talked about transit plans that are sitting on shelves, God knows where. What do you mean we don't have a plan?
And there were a lot of people in the room who took issue with that. They were not happy hearing those words spoken because that was exactly what they said. They said, look, we have the plans. We know what we want to do. We just have not put this into a coherent campaign to really tell people and energize them about it. So there's disagreement even within the group that is exploring this.
I think those plans even keep changing. If you look down Independence, originally it was supposed to be a light rail, and then it was this bus rapid transit, and but now it's back to light rail.
No. In fairness, these plans do have to change. I mean, federal government programs change, people's preferences change. So I don't think that's the problem. I think the issue is that it's all delivered in such muddled acronyms that nobody knows what the heck is being discussed.
Yes, but CATS, the Charlotte Area Transit System people say that they're in the process of sort of refreshing their 2030 plan, which is some of the Independence Boulevard.
Talk about a soul sucking phrase, 2030 plan. I mean, nobody. It's just like, oh my God, I want to hang myself. You know, they're going to have to put this into English. One of the things they did in Denver was, I think they said, you'll spend whatever it was, 4 cents more or 40 cents more on every $10 you spend, and it will get you there quicker and get your neighbors off the road. That's easy. You can understand that.
Right.
2030 plan via federal grant XXR divided by pi. Nobody knows.
Right. Yeah. So will this trip to Denver have any impact?
I think it will because I think you're going to see a big proposal come out of this. Now, whether it will succeed, who knows, but I do think you're going to see an ambitious transit proposal.
And I also think the new CAT CEO, John Lewis, he's pushing a lot of new programs. We talked to him this week about partnering with CATS, partnering with rideshare services, the Ubers and the Lyfts. Mm-hmm. He's calling it the 1 mile to get you there and 1 mile to get you away. So if you live a mile away from the nearest light rail station or a bus rapid transit station, it's a lot cheaper for them to possibly subsidize that Uber ride than it is for them to send a 40-foot bus.
So let's talk about the Donald before we run out of time here. Donald Trump, now the presumptive GOP nominee, some establishment Republicans very worried about this, and RNC Chairman Reince Priebus told party members this week that it's time to unite behind the candidate, and yet
Paul Ryan didn't hear him,
get that message. No. North Carolina Senator Richard Burr has welcomed Trump to the general election fight. U.S. Representative Robert Pittenger says he fully supports Trump. But North Carolina State Senator Tom Apodaca, who chairs the Senate Rules Committee in Raleigh, says, I haven't decided if I'm voting for president yet. Don't blame me. I voted for Jeb Bush. So what impact might a Trump candidacy have on the down-ballot races here in North Carolina?
Well, I mean, that's the whole wild card. You know, I was with a group of reporters interviewing Roy Cooper this week, and he was asked about Hillary Clinton at the top of the ticket. And he immediately said, I really have a lot of concerns about Donald Trump on the ballot. So that tells you exactly where this is going to go on both sides. And it also gives you some insight into Roy Cooper being a little hesitant to immediately. He did eventually say Hillary Clinton will be a good candidate. That wasn't his first response. Yeah,
Trump hate is more powerful than Hillary support.
Well, and that's the question here. I mean, long before we saw that letter from the U.S. Justice Department about HB2, I kind of wondered if we were going to see, to Eric's column, if we were going to see House Bill 2 as a constitutional amendment in North Carolina on the ballot as a way to motivate a lot of base Republicans who could not coalesce around a potential candidacy of Donald Trump. Well, that's not potential anymore. He is the de facto nominee. What's interesting to me is these are the two least popular major party candidates ever to face each other. Think about that.
Aren't we lucky?
For a second. And so it's one thing, it's very easy for us to say, hey, look, the Republicans don't really know if Donald Trump is a real conservative. How is it that he's winning the evangelical vote? But the Democratic candidate, who, likely candidate, carries a whole lot of baggage as well. So
that's what struck me about Cooper's response.
Yeah, it's a great point.
He was immediately terrified of saying, yeah, I'm all on Team Hillary. He immediately went to Trump's the problem.
One of the craziest things I saw is the day after he became the de facto nominee, CNN and ORC came out with a poll that basically broke down a hypothetical head-to-head between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And the majority of voters who would support either candidate wouldn't cast that vote in support of that candidate. They were voting against the other candidate. So
I've heard people say this is the pick your poison election. So do you pick the one poison that's going to make you sick, make you throw up, or do you pick the poison that's going to kill you?
Well, let's talk about vice president, because clearly Carly Fiorina will not be on the Trump ticket.
Is that the shortest vice presidential run ever? It was like a week, right?
So sad.
We're out. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has been rumored to be a possible VP running mate. What are her chances? What, if anything, has she said about Donald Trump?
She said no.
Yeah, no,
she'd be crazy to accept it.
I mean, actually heard her as a third party candidate.
Really?
If that hypothetical run, and I speculated a long time ago that after how she handled the Confederate flag coming down, her incredible response to the State of the Union, which was really widely seen as being great,
yes.
That she was going to be on a short list for VP. Also, a minority woman. How nice is that for a Republican ticket that often goes just to white people? But the problem is she says no. Everybody else has said no. So now you're just kind of basically saying,
there's one person who's saying yes.
Gingrich.
Newt.
Newt and the mute Chris Christie, who would be allowed to speak again if he were put on the ticket.
And another Southerner, Franklin Graham, has been rumored, although it's said that Trump is going to be looking for somebody with Washington experience. I don't know why. But Franklin Graham has been rumored because he beat Trump to the punch in calling for a blockade of Muslims coming into the country.
That's true.
Yes, but it's still a very controversial candidacy. And again, it's amazing that Donald Trump has continued to significantly win the votes of evangelicals, even though he has been divorced three times, an acknowledged adulterer, a casino magnate, you name it. But I'm curious if Franklin Graham would want to tie himself to that ticket and then potentially, if they lose, potentially be seen as something that was incredibly damaging to the Republican brand writ large and conservatism and evangelical conservatism in general.
And damaging to the Graham name.
Does anything need to be said about the Hornets playoff games?
So sad.
Ooh, that was quick.
Yeah. Does anything need to be said about the Wells Fargo PGA Championship, which is underway even as we speak?
A very wonderful forecast for the weekend, so I think everybody will be happy.
And perhaps we should tell them next time, let's leave the Twitter pictures for a bit of mile alone.
Yeah. And getting the whole guy, stay at home.
Yeah. All right, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, which can be seen on Time Warner Cable. We'll tell you how to use next time you're back. We'll tell you how you best use your services. Eric Frazier from The Observer and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thanks for the hour.